Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. That brings me to my guest, who is waiting patiently and joining us live remotely from his home in near Taos, New Mexico. Archaeologist Paul Reed is on the program today. Paul, good morning. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Scott. Glad to see you. I'm glad to be back.
Good to have you back, of course. And we can hear you and we can see you. So I'm all excited that the technology is working today. So
that's right.
Go us. Very good. Well, as I mentioned, I kind of thought it'd be interesting to talk since we just got through an election in this country, of course, and watch the votes being counted as they continue to be across the country. That what do we know about leadership in the ancient world? At Chaco Canyon, of course, and some of the other ancestral Puebloan towns and villages that we talk about on this program with you on a regular basis. I know that you've done some work on this, and there are some other theories on how leaders were chosen or just selected. So I thought that'd be kind of cool for a topic of a show today. And so what can you tell us of what we know? At least let's start with Chaco Canyon, because I know you've done a lot of work there.
Right. Sure. Well, the short answer is Chaco had leadership.
Right.
And that's I'm not sure that's breathtaking news.
All right. Well, we'll see you next month. Thank you, Paul.
That's right. I love it when we check these boxes fast. And
that's right.
Well, no, I mean, it's, you know, I do tours, of course, in Chaco, and I've done a lot of writing for the public on Chaco, and it's a common question that comes up. And I think, you know, one of the contrasts that I like to draw for people is that, you know, in the modern world, of course, you know, we live in, you know, from a political standpoint and the way political anthropologists would classify things, a complicated state level society. So, you know, there's different schema that people have proposed and worked through, but, and I'm dating myself here, the one I grew up with, grew up in the sense of my anthropological and archaeological training, you know, is a fairly simple, straightforward topology that talks about groups moving from a band level society to a tribal level, to a chiefdom level, to a state level. And any of my colleagues who might catch this are probably, you know, especially the younger ones, just hitting their heads against the wall, because we have gotten more sophisticated through time in how we look at these models. But the reason I like that relatively straightforward, you know, band to chief to tribe, to band to tribe, to chiefdom to state, is it helps us kind of have an initial starting point to talk about it. So modern industrial society is very complicated. You know, our country has 330 million people. We have multiple levels of jurisdiction in our state, you know, in our state level society, and as well as our state of New Mexico. So if we go to the past, we do find that in general, political organization is not as complicated. You know, there's certainly exceptions, but you know, people track sort of the evolution of political complexity to, you know, the agrarian revolution, you know, depending upon where we're in the world, 10,000 to 7 or 8,000 years ago. That's when we really start to see the emergence of full-time leaders. Before that, for much of our time on the planet as humans, people moved in relatively small groups, you know, that we might call bands or extended family groups. And leadership mostly in those cases tied to different individuals who had proven themselves over time to have the qualities that, you know, those little small bands wanted in leadership.
Right.
So, you know, this is sort of the classic good old days, I guess, if you want to look at it compared to our behemoth and, you know, intricately complicated system now. And those leaders, you know, were not necessarily men, they probably did tend to be older members of society. We know that, you know, many, many groups value the contributions of women and the accumulated knowledge through those lines, those matriarchal lines. So, you know, that's the model that we have for a big portion of our time on the planet when people were mostly moving to the resources, right? They were hunting. They were going to places where natural plants would come out, you know, certain times of year. Once people settle down and we have sedentism, then, you know, the leadership thing really gets more complicated, and so does most of the things that, that tie to these different societies. So Chaco, of course, is the center of a Pueblo agricultural society that developed over thousands of years down there. And by the time Chaco becomes what we recognize as Chaco, say in the 900s to, you know, 1000 and after, they're building these amazing buildings. People are growing lots of corn. You know, there's all this activity going on. Chaco had, you know, in my view, a very well-organized leadership system. But, you know, when we excavate sites as archaeologists or read through records as historians, different kinds of researchers, you know, we can't, in archaeology anyway, excavate leadership, right? This is an abstract concept. So we have to take the things that we find in archaeological contexts and sites, artifacts, the way things are distributed, and say, well, we think this informs what we want to understand about, say, leadership. So, you know, that's a long preamble.
Right. That's okay. Because I asked you.
That's the background, I think, to, you know, at least one approach to trying to understand leadership.
Right.
And talk. So,
but I guess in a broader sense, Paul Reed, couldn't we say, I mean, it's just, I guess, human nature that we have leaders in our groups, whatever that may be. I mean, you mentioned even hunter gatherers, you know, if I had a good kill, I may be now the leader of the group because I had a good kill and provided food for my group for a few days or what have you. Right.
Right. And that's a great point because, you know, in the past and even today, a lot of leadership, you know, that we see at different levels is based on a person's individual qualities that are perceived by the group to be leadership qualities. Like you said, maybe a good hunter, maybe someone who
chicken in every pot.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who understands the land
right
in the best way, because if you're a hunter gatherer, you know, in a group, a band like that, you're having to move around and you got to know where those resources are at what time of year. And of course, you know, the climate is an influence on that, but you need that accumulated leadership. So again, I think the leadership tends to favor, you know, the older folks just because they've had more time.
Right. And I suppose, I keep interrupting you and I apologize, Paul Reed, but I wanted to ask too. And I guess if you can't then provide, maybe if there's a food shortage or a food spoilage, or I keep going back to food, maybe because I had a small breakfast today or something, but but if you can't provide for your followers, for your group, then I guess that would maybe even put pressure on a change in leadership as well, right? We see some of that over time.
Right. And you know, what we see with, you know, band level groups, and even for some that, you know, are a little more complicated than that, is that, you know, people vote with their feet too. Let's say you've got a group that's come together with five or six related, pretty large families. Maybe you have 50 people, you know, encamped in an area for a time. If part of the group is not happy with the leadership or where, you know, the group is talking about going next, then they'll vote with their feet and they'll go off on their own. So that, you know, that was one of the main options to avoid, I think, conflict in the past, you know, before population got to a certain point. I mean, once you have people in a lot of different areas on the planet or on a continent or whatever piece of territory, then voting with your feet is not really much of an option unless there are areas you can go to and find those resources. So anyway, that's one thing we look at. The other thing I was going to mention, you know, as I'm talking about the leadership, you know, in some of these more traditional older societies, mostly, you know, skewing to the older folks with the experience. The contrast for that, of course, is what we see in ancient Egypt. And this is not my area of expertise, as you know, but you think about, you know, the important tombs and, you know, the long dynasties that developed there. And we have, of course, King Tutankhamun, King Tut, you know, buried in one of the most richly appointed burial sites on the planets that, you know, as developed there, and we have, of course, so in common, you know, clearly, you know, very once one of the most leadership develops and becomes hereditary, then it changes the ball game. You know, as developed there, you know, leadership automatically going to someone who clearly have the most knowledge. So I'm not suggesting that Chaco had that kind of hereditary leadership. You know, we don't, I don't personally believe leadership automatically. The contrast, of course, is Steve Black. So I'm not suggesting that Steve has written extensively
Let me stop you there for a minute, Paul. We're getting a little bit of audio feedback, and I don't know why that's happening. So hold on one second while I try to just check a couple of things here, and we'll bring you back in just a second. I apologize, viewers and listeners, for that.
For a minute, Paul. We're getting
now. I'm getting myself coming back, but I think maybe I fixed it. Let's try that again, Paul. All right, we'll try it again with Paul Reed. I apologize, and let's see. Can you still hear me? All right, Paul.
Yeah, it sounds good on my end.
Okay, you were getting a little audio loop coming back through, which was very strange, but okay. I think we're good for the moment. So, new technology, okay. We love it. But please continue. I'm sorry we interrupted you again.
Well, it's that's fine. We're keeping it real. So whatever's happening is what's happening right now. So anyway, Steve Lexon, you know, who we've talked about on the show, and Steve has made great contributions in the field. Steve believes that the leadership was more formalized in Chaco, and he goes so far as to use the notion of nobles and commoners and, you know, borrowing sort of a European or otherworldly model. And, you know, some of us aren't as comfortable with that. I mean, I'm pretty clear in my own mind that Chaco had distinct leaders and that those leaders were able to do more than simply persuade or encourage the people they were leading, you know, to engage in a behavior. One of the real simple models we use is, you know, in the Amish world and other agrarian societies in our own country's past, people would do barn raisings, right?
Sure.
So you know that you were putting up a barn that day, and you'd prep your materials and build what you could, but then you would invite families from the surrounding area so that you could end up with 50 to 100 plus people. And, you know, in particular, a lot of strong young people to help you pull up the walls of the barn. So that's a kind of leadership that we describe as situational. So in other words, when you need the barn raised, it's your place. And so whoever's the leader in that, you know, small family outfit says, hey, I need help. So people come in, they cooperate, they get the barn raised. And, you know, after a couple of days, whatever amount of time, people go back and they do their own things. And maybe the next time it's the Jones family that need a barn raising. But you don't have a permanent political structure in place that, you know, is the barn raising committee. I mean, you know, Right. Well, maybe there is a committee, but yes. You know, the point is it comes and goes, and then people are back to mostly just getting along as you know, relative equals.
Sure.
I don't equate Chaco to any kind of barn raising move because there's too much going on in Chaco for especially those decades in the 900s and the early 1000s and up to 1100. There's just a whole lot of activity. So, you know, my thought is you have permanent leadership. I'm not sure it was hereditary, passed from a parent to a child in whatever form, but it certainly, they had clear lines of leadership and they knew how they were going to choose their leaders and that they were going to have leadership the whole way that Chaco was occupied.
Right.
So it wasn't a temporary thing. It was a permanent thing. And, you know, if you visited Chaco as an outsider from a different tribal group, you know, and asked to be presented to a leader, you would have been presented to someone who was, you know, one of the leaders in Chaco. So, and I use that example just to make it clear that it's not like you're going to end up with 50 people staring around at each other going, you know, we're not sure. Now, Right. Decision-making is an interesting portion of this, you know, and the Pueblos today, and we can talk about this a little more later, but the Pueblos today, all of them have councils that deliberate on different matters. And in general, and there are some exceptions, but in general, they have to reach decisions communally. So there needs to be unanimous agreement at the end of a process of debate about whether they're going to put in, you know, this water system or whatever the project they might be doing, you know, on their own Pueblo lands. So, and, you know, certainly disagreements come up, but there are mechanisms in place to work through those. So one of the real interesting questions about, you know, ancient societies like Chaco and what happened at Aztec and Salmon and across Mesa Verde and a big portion of the northern Southwest is, were these sites managed by essentially similar councils, you know, where people would get together and discuss it? And did you ultimately have sort of an executive type leader who, you know, today many of the Pueblos have a leader in place that's a Spanish word, it's called cacique. And for many of them, that's their ultimate sort of supreme religious person in charge of that portion of their society. Well, when the Spanish came in, they introduced basically civil leadership to the Pueblos, that was a complement, if you will, and it's sometimes an opposing force, you know, and sometimes created some factions, but you had governors and then a whole staff of people who were tied to the governor position in the Pueblos, and they retain these to this day. About six of the Pueblos plus the Hopis elect those governors. The other about two-thirds, almost 15, those are appointed by the council at the end of a calendar year. So there's this interesting mix, you know, and diversity of leadership. But I think it's fair to say that there is a certain communalism to that. Now, the councils are, you know, at this point, I believe for the Pueblos, they're all men. So I don't believe there are women on the Pueblo councils at this point. And they're relatively small groups. So, you know, we have 10 to 12, sometimes as many as 14 or 15. And they're right. making decisions for a Pueblo like at Zuni that might have 5,000 or 6,000 people. So it is a fairly small leadership group. And, you know, some things do get put to all the members of a Pueblo through referenda and similar things. But most of the leadership group is fairly small.
Interesting.
At this point. So, and again, it's hard to reconstruct that looking back at Chaco. You know, and other people, again, sort of the Steve Lexon model, go to Chaco, see what's going on, and said, yeah, this had to be really well organized and, you know, leaders who were probably hereditary leaders and who were maybe considered nobility by people to think.
Right.
Now, the question of nobility in Pueblo society, like I said, is a tricky one. And we really don't see the signs that we have for nobility everywhere else in the world, which is generally personal wealth accrual. So you don't have super, super rich, you know, deposits in particular places in many of the sites we studied that would say, okay, this is definitely the home of the leader. So that's one of the things that gives us some pause as we consider sort of the aspects of leadership in the past.
Right. Interesting. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, is here. He works with Archaeology Southwest. He's done a lot of work at Chaco Canyon and Salmon Ruins, of course, here in San Juan County. And it sounds like, at least from me listening to you, Paul, that we see over time maybe the separation of church and state, that maybe originally some of these leaders were religious leaders as well as maybe political leaders, for lack of a better term, with some of these groups of people. And then over time, they decided to maybe the religious leader would be on one side, and then the political leaders or the other community leaders would take on other jobs and make other decisions for the larger group. Does that make any sense?
Right. It's definitely true. And one of the other things that I, you know, when I'm thinking about these societies in the past, and particularly in the ancient Pueblo world, is, you know, I try to remind people that, you know, with our Western style of thinking, we like to divide things out, right? So we dichotomize, we quadcotomize,
right.
I don't know if that's the word, but, you know, we say this is over here, here's the economics, here's the social system, here's the political system, here's the religious system. One of the things that I think helps us, helps me have hopefully better insight on Chaco, is to try not to divide things so much, but to think of it as more of a unified whole. And this is something that I have learned from some of my interactions with Pueblo friends and colleagues, and I'm certainly not trying to represent their viewpoints here, but I think for Pueblo people, present and past, the world's a more integrated place. So the notion even of having, quote, a secular leader versus a religious one, you know, maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them.
Right.
The system that the Spanish introduced, on the other hand, was a definite dichotomization of what may have been single integrated positions of leadership. So again, you end up with a supreme, you know, with a religious leader, a cacique, a head priest in a different society. And then you have the Spanish imposed governor and all the staff there. In the past, though, I'm not sure those things existed. So this is a somewhat roundabout answer to get to this. But so people have thought that perhaps Chaco was governed through, you know, a religious hierarchy of people who were at the heads of these religious societies and within different portions of, say, Pueblo Bonito, and that the leadership then rested with people at the top of those hierarchies, people who decided when to plant, people who may have watched the skies for different, you know, movements, telling them now's the time to plant, now's the time to harvest, you know, people who looked for rain and were in charge of, you know, that aspect of the ceremonialism, you know, how to bring the rains, you know, a huge concern for agricultural peoples worldwide. So I'm not sure we can even really try to slice this out and say, well, Chaco had this kind of political leadership, because, you know, we think the ceremonialism and the religion, the religious aspect was so important that there probably wasn't those differences.
Sure. You
know, at least those are the thoughts that I have.
Right.
You know,
and you mentioned the other areas that we're familiar with, of course, Salmon ruins, Aztec ruins, even maybe Mesa Verde, that we certainly know were linked to Chaco and Chaco Canyon. But I guess what we maybe don't know, or what we're still looking into, is, you know, how much governance came from a central location, if Chaco was the overall end-all to that society, or if they were given autonomy to deal with their own local issues. Or maybe we do know a little bit more than maybe I know. You probably know more than I do. I know you that you do.
Well,
that's a fact.
That's, you know, well, I appreciate the question, Scott, because that really goes to the heart of this, what we talk about as Chaco and society, or the Pueblo society in the past at Chaco. You know, so we have certainly Pueblo developments over a number of areas in the 800s, in the mid 800s, the 900s. A lot of things coalesced in Chaco in this time period by 900, 950. And then we begin to see across the landscape, first to the south, and then to the north and west and other areas, people building sites that look like Chacoan sites. And in some cases, as you know, some research we did a few years ago, we're basically able to demonstrate through different lines of material culture that, yeah, people actually left Chaco to build first the site at Salmon at about 1090, and then begin with the Aztec community at 1100 and working through the 1100s there. So those cases seem to be an example of people leaving this place at Chaco that was their home for a long time and saying, we're going to venture out here, you know, and part of the discussion that's ensued on this is people say, well, it's only 50 or 60 miles from Chaco to these areas. This isn't really new territory. The interesting thing is we don't have a whole lot of Pueblo sites in the area surrounding either Salmon on the San Juan or Aztec on the Animas before we begin to see people coming out of Chaco and going up there. So if it was part of a larger Pueblo territory, you know, I think, which we could probably say, it wasn't really, they weren't part of the Chacoan system until there was a commitment to build those sites.
Interesting.
Now, leadership at Salmon and Aztec, I think, was probably fairly closely tied, especially in the early years, to what was happening in Chaco Canyon. But what I also, the contrast I like to make for people, and, you know, is this wasn't like a Roman system. So Rome was what we'd classify as a complicated state-level society. Obviously, it was 2,000 years ago. It was pre-industrial. But the Romans, you know, for anybody who studied this, were highly organized. They built roads everywhere. They put in different Roman villas and basically administrative centers over a huge portion of Europe into the Middle East, a little bit of Asia, you know, all the way as far west as England. That's not what Chaco was. So, you know, we can talk about similarities. The Chacoans also spread out over a large geographic territory, covering portions of the four modern states, an area about the size of country of Ireland, or, you know, the state of Indiana or Ohio, you know, something like 30 million acres, a big area. But, you know, this wasn't a state level society. There weren't the millions of people that we think were tied to Rome spread. Chaco, as far as we know, didn't have large standing armies ready to, you know, conquer and pull in adjacent territory. You know, those kinds of things happened well to the south. The Aztecs were an expansionary, you know, empire that started in the early 15th century and then, you know, dominated a huge portion of what we call Mexico today. Chaco wasn't that. So Chaco seems to be more of some spread from the center, but then local leaders saying, we're going to connect to Chaco. We're going to build one of these large buildings that signifies membership in this larger Chaco political religious system, you know, if that's what it was, you know, and then we're going to produce items that we can make in our area, whether that's pottery, whether that's wood and timber for building, whether it's, you know, good napping stone to make projectile points and other tools, you know, a whole range of things, food. You know, one of the things about the expansion into the San Juan Valley at Salmon and the Animas Valley at Aztec is people were probably growing lots and lots of food that was then circulating through Chaco and other sites at that time. So it seems to be more a matter of, you know, not an entirely voluntary organization, but people coming together to be part of this society, bound together by the Chacoan architecture, by the Chacoan ritual system, which again, you know, we have just a real sort of initial understanding of, and that it wasn't a militaristic expansionary empire. So
interesting. Right.
And I think it was a great deal of local autonomy too. That's my feeling.
Okay. Interesting. It almost sounds communal in a way, Paul Reed. And
right.
We just have a couple of minutes remaining this morning. And I guess maybe the other differences too, between Roman history and even maybe Egyptian history, is maybe the lack of writing anything down. And that's the one thing that we don't see right at Chaco. We have some maybe things that were like paintings and designs and things like that, but really no other either written type of language, at least that's been discovered thus far. Isn't that true?
Right, right. So we don't have, you know, even like you have in Mesoamerica, the stelae that, you know, list the rulers and different Mayan dynasties through time. And, you know, it's unclear exactly why those kinds of record keeping systems didn't come up from the south to the north. You know, we know looking at the way things develop that, you know, the notion of sedentism, living in a place permanently, growing different types of crops, that those things spread from greater Mesoamerica into first the area in Arizona that we call the Hohokam or Huhugam area, and then over into the Pueblo Southwest, but not this record-keeping thing and this writing on the stone. Now, we do have petroglyphs and pictographs that record different things that were obviously important to folks in the past, but not something that we can say this is an alphabet, you know, or that, you know, even along the lines of hieroglyphics or any of the Mayan things, you know. And I, the way people talk about that, at least, is that, you know, we don't have the population density and really the need for those systems to be in place. If we look at areas to the south, we have hundreds of thousands and even millions of people that were part of these different empires. The Toltec Empire pretty much overlaps perfectly with Chaco, and that's around, you know, modern Mexico City in north, the Mayans to the south and east at the same time period, and then, of course, later the Aztecs, you know, well after people had left Chaco.
Right.
These are large expansionary groups who did use military means and other things to, you know, control a very large population. It does look more communal, to circle back to your point. You know, but again, with enough leadership in there that we're not just, hey, we're going to build Pueblo Bonito. It's a barn raising, you know. And certainly I think people were willing to contribute their labor to these different construction projects, you know, and to go 50 miles away into the Chusca Mountains to the west to cut wood, to let the wood season, bring back seasoned wood, you know. And the really cool thing about that is we have a tree ring record with dates from early in the 900s all the way through the 1100s, and wood was cut every single year.
And wow.
It may not have been absolutely stockpiled centrally. There probably were stockpiles, you know, resource piles, if you will, that were tied to this site and that site. But the interesting thing is it happened every single year, and that indicates a real organized, systematic system to cut the wood, age it, and bring it in for use in these projects. So,
and that's some long-term planning too, right? I mean, because we're talking over
long-term
a year.
Long-term planning, and that's what we see in the sites is, you know, here's where we're going to build it. This is what we envision for the total size. And we're going to build it relatively quickly,
you know,
over 10 to 15 years. Pueblo Bonito is an exception because that site starts in the mid-800s and has some construction activity well into the after 81,000 and even some minor repairs into the 1100s. Most of the big Chacoan sites are planned and built on a scale of just a few decades. You know, at Salmon, you know, the site that I know best, of course, we've got wood being cut from the mid-800s all the way up, I'm sorry, the mid-1000s, 1080s, okay, all the way up to about 1090. And then most of the site put up a three-story pueblo built completely by 1106 or 1107.
Amazing.
So, you know, wow, an intensive, you know, no more than 20-year construction project. And, you know, thousands of pieces of wood, millions of pieces of individual sandstone that were, you know, chiseled, snapped to position, set into the walls. And yeah, so nothing to say, well, this is just a small task groups and the barn raising, but
right,
not Rome either. So I hope that makes some sense to folks. And it's not all about classifying, you know, indigenous sites according to some European scale either. It's, we can appreciate things for what they are and try to understand them. And that's why I bring up the other New World examples to
sure,
the south. But it does help to have a sense of scale and say, okay, you know, for Greater Chaco, we're looking at tens of thousands of people. We're not talking hundreds of thousands or millions like we have in these other places worldwide. And so you can do things more communally with smaller group sizes.
Right.
You know, you need the leadership, but it works a little differently.
True. But it still shows, I think, that there was someone in these positions or a group of people in these positions making these decisions that we're going to build this here and we're going to build it this size. We're going to contribute or plan this many of our resources and workers to do this over this many years or whatever the case may be. So obviously somebody had to be making those decisions at some point.
And you have to have durable leadership that goes from generation to generation to make that happen. So that's why the barn raising model doesn't work. And the, oh, well, this person's going to be a temporary crew boss over here and then we'll hand off. Now, rotating leadership is certainly possible, but you have to have that core of planners and builders and architects to, you know, these buildings are still standing. I tell people, and, you know, they were built as monuments. And that's one of the reasons they built them in stone so massively and so tall, is they had a vision of the site still being on the landscape in 1,000 years, I mean, in my view.
Right.
And they did a great job because they're still here. And we're fortunate that, you know, people intervened early enough in Chaco's history and the history of other places to keep the pot hunters and the looters away, the people who would knock down the walls and steal all the amazing items, and that enough of those of our sites were preserved, you know, for everyone to enjoy today.
Very true. Well, and we're grateful for folks like you who help us understand what we're looking at these wonderful sites. So, Paul, thank you so much. We're out of time, is what happens to us, but it's been a fascinating conversation today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Scott. And talking about Chaco, it's a little bit of an arm twist, but you know.
<It's>... That's okay. We appreciate it. And the insights are great and fascinating. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll talk to you again next month. That is archaeologist Paul Reed from Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins, my guest here on KSJE. And I'll be back with more in just a moment, everybody. Of course, the time right now is 8:45. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.